Afternoon, everyone. Look to move into one of the last panel sessions. Can have your attention. Here, looking to talk about aspects of attracting technology innovators and applications to invasive species challenges. So this is really about, you know, how do you bring others into this? There's an excellent book called Thinker Toys, for those of you that may have read it. Essentially, it compiles a whole suite of different ways in which you can think about and actually develop aspects of innovation. I recommend it for any of those of you that are interested in developing potentially new aspects of innovation for problems. And we've seen here today, you know, some really excellent aspects when we've looked at, you know, how do you do innovation? And frequently, you know, these aspects that you've seen from various aspects are multidisciplinary. So you yourself or you and your small team may not be able to take these things on alone. So frequently you're having to look at and reach out for partnerships. How do you do that? Aspects that we've seen today as examples included the bioballistic application of herbicides, for example, bringing paintball technology and bringing it out of a helicopter to put it on top of plants. But the technology already existed. The aspect that was currently there was paintballs, and then it was just applying it in a different way. One of the other ones that we saw, if I can bring it up again, the Oxitec mosquitoes work. You know, the aspect of sterile insect technique is not new. So there the Oxitec model builds upon aspects of what had traditionally been done through aspects of screwworm eradication and other things, really leveraging their sterile insect technique that was typically done through radiation. And they've added on and essentially done it better, been able to increase aspects of fitness of the individuals that they're releasing to be able to make them more effective. So these aspects of how does innovation come together? How do you actually do it? What is it? What are the pieces? It's infrequently something that's pulled out of the blue and then magically solves your problem. More often than not, it's something that's actually applied from a different field and brought in and applied. And there's lots of potential for that, you know, still. So some of the aspects that we wanted to talk with you guys a little bit about today and get some discussion going here was this. So how do you engage those others? Yeah, so once you've articulated your question and really had your sort of problem statement well articulated, how then do you move on with that? How else do you engage with others? How do you identify them? Where might they be? So part on that, I think I've already spoken probably enough, and I'll hand over a little bit to Alex Deegan from Conservation X Labs to share with you some of his thoughts.
So I think that there's a lot of overlap with session two from earlier today, and I just want to make really five really quick points in terms of thinking about this. First, as Carl pointed out, this is not a problem that's unique to conservation. It's true of other fields. It's true of international development. It goes back to my comments on experts, that we're at a period of time where the experts can now best define the problems but aren't in charge of all the solutions that we have out there. I think the advantages are we have this generation that is more interested in working on these types of problems than ever before. At Duke, where I teach, we have a conservation technology club that has literally formed from different disciplines actually working together because they want to actually address these problems. And they're going to lead a conservation technology makers fair at the Smithsonian Earth Optimism Summit that's coming up on Earth Day. At University of California, Berkeley, the biggest class that they have in the school is one that's focused on development and the challenges that we have on development. So I think we actually have a great opportunity to harness and bring in new people than ever before. I think the second is to recognize the limitations of a field of conservation science that was set up over 30 years ago. And you know, if you think about the field, the last person you probably want to invite to dinner is a conservation biologist, right? We are literally some of the most depressing people on Earth. We have set up an entire discipline to denote and record and lament the passing of species. We can be technophobic, backwards looking, it's just not fun. It is really clear from looking at the helicopter and the ballistic technology and everything else that we're talking about is that there's plenty of opportunities to have fun. And part of our goal, and I think part of the goal of we can do this, is that optimism needs to be part of the messaging and the marketing that we actually take on. And that itself can attract people to what we're trying to do. I think the third is one of our fundamental goals should be how do we broaden the tent for conservation? How do we bring in new entrants from fields such as engineering, microbiology, synthetic biology, behavioral economics, marketing, data science? Global health itself went through this transformation, right? It used to be called tropical medicine, and it was made up of almost entirely physicians who tended to be white males who understood what all the problems were and understood what all the solutions were. It has evolved into this field of global health that is much more than just medicine, but it involves economics, it involves behavior, it involves anthropology, it involves engineering within its actually makeup. And I think we can learn a lot from taking such a multidisciplinary approach, and part of it is actually creating the enabling environments, what that second session talked about, the ecosystem that's necessary. And we have a lot of new tools, including at the federal government, that have been pioneered by this administration to look at these things. Prizes and challenges to bring in new solvers and solutions, mass collaboration and co-creation within what we're trying to do. And we also need to kind of change our fundamental models of academia that focus on single disciplinary solutions to problem-oriented education. I've always said, right, we want our students not to ask what is your major, but what is your problem. And changing that aspect of how we incentivize people to work on these problems within academia and translate that knowledge, I think, is key. The last is just, I think storytelling and marketing is going to be a critical component of this. And this isn't something, science communications isn't something conservation scientists are actually very good at. And it's a question of whether we need to be good at all the elements of the piece or we really need to partner together with others to be able to actually make this matter. The fact is the moral imperative by itself of doing the right thing, of protecting species, will probably be insufficient to get people to act. But it's questions of identity, it's questions of actually realizing the cost that this provides to our infrastructure, that the opportunities that are there in terms of new jobs and new fields that can be created, that the ways we can address this will change the conversation. Just one last note, one of the things that we're working on is what I think is one of the very first mass collaboration, open innovation platforms for conservation technology, both biological and engineering. And for us, there's really three questions that matter. How do you build and maintain a community, a multidisciplinary community that speaks literally different languages and have different terms of art? How do you lower the barriers for entry? And what are the incentives for participation? And this is something we're really grappling with right now to try to figure out, and I think it's critical to the very things that we're talking about today.
Excellent, thanks, Alex. And Johanna Wolfson from the Department of Energy.
Hi, good afternoon, good to be here with you all. I'm the person on this panel who knows nothing about invasive species or really conservation in general, so thanks for having me. I did hope to get here a little bit earlier so I could soak up some of the wisdom, but I didn't, so I'm cold. My role at the Department of Energy is to develop and direct technology to market strategy for the part of the Department of Energy that focuses on energy efficiency and renewable energy. And the way we think about that is really we take a kind of a platform or holistic approach to the innovation ecosystem. And while DOE is a funding agency, and while the piece of DOE in which I work is a large sub-agency at $2 billion per year of funding R&D, our operation is actually a really capital-light operation where we're trying to identify very high-leverage opportunities to align the ecosystem, the innovation ecosystem in a particular way, so as to encourage innovation and to bring promising ideas to market. And so while we normally, at least within the Department of Energy, think about tech transfer or tech to market or commercialization efforts, in sort of a project by project way of thinking about this is a promising place. We've put our money. We want to put additional horsepower behind bringing this to consumers or to the market. What we're doing is very complementary, and we're saying we actually want to develop new approaches so that those focusing on individual projects can be more successful. Some examples of that our Cleantech University Prize program, where we sponsor eight universities around the country to host student competitions, not just at their universities, but including students from their regions. That's really the kind of the front end program where we have, it's a bit more focused on workforce development. We're looking to encourage smart, young innovators to throw their life's work into the energy problem. And that's one of the ways that we do that. We also have programs that are more focused on structural approaches to opening up resources for those who are working on individual solutions. We have programs that we've tried to really lower the barriers for those entities to access capital and access physical resources. I saw on the agenda that you guys heard earlier from Woosh, the guys at the Salmon Cannon. They were actually an awardee of our Small Business Vouchers program, which awards small businesses with access to the national labs if they have something they need to prove out. And they can do that then with more capital efficiency. So the design of those platforms that others can then plug into is really central to our approach. So I'll keep the rest of my comments brief. I wanted to just give it a sense of what I'm doing so that you all in the audience and the moderator can pick out what might be interesting for me to talk more about. A couple notes that I just jotted down as I was listening that might be relevant is it sounds like there's a lot of effort in this community to focus on finding adjacencies in technology areas that are relevant. So solutions that may have been developed in other areas and could be applicable to the types of challenges that this community is working on. That's terrific. One model, I don't know if it's been talked about today, but that we're looking at is, and that sort of reminds me of this challenge, is the DIUX model within the Department of Defense, where they're specifically looking at technologies that were developed for other purposes and spending the time to ruggedize them or make them appropriate for that challenge. I think that most of the efforts that we support, and I'm guessing it is transitive, are gonna fall into either that bucket of encouraging innovators to work on the challenges of interest on the one hand, and helping individual promising solutions become viable in the marketplace or in the field on the other hand. And those aren't mutually exclusive, right? If you do a good job of the first, then you'll have more options to choose from on the second. If you do a good job of the second, then you're actually creating this green light passageway for innovators. They can look at this and see, oh, there's a good viable route here. So they're very complementary, but they are somewhat different. So as those in this community are thinking about designing programs, it tends to be useful to think about which sub problem are you solving, and for the latter, where you're looking at the progress of individual solutions toward implementation in the field or in the market, I just think it's very critical to ask what is the common business case, and there's not always going to be one uniform business case, but the more commonalities that you can identify among individual pathways toward market or field implementation, the more easily can a program be designed that's going to help many people at once and ultimately give you more shots on goal to solve some of the biggest challenges that you're facing. And then lastly, at the Department of Energy, we do have a strong focus on public-private collaboration. And this is sometimes challenging within a government agency. Although it's something that everyone likes to talk about and say, yes, we like to work with the private sector, in reality, there are constructs that make it difficult to do so. But we are trying to push on those boundaries, and by all means, if we can be helpful to other agencies in adapting and other entities in adapting some of what we've learned to other challenges that require audacious innovation, we'd really love to do that. Thanks.
Excellent, Johanna. Thank you. And Ken Redford from Archipelago Consulting.
Thank you, Carl. So I don't know whether it's occurred to anybody else, but somebody like me, who's an aging white male, to be in the Museum of the American Indian talking about invasive species makes me feel really quite uncomfortable. And besides trying to be amusing at this time of evening when most people are fading, there also is an important point here, which I have learned the hard way, and I'm sure others can compare scars with me, but the question of who we is a really important question, and this is really the subject of the panel. So we can do it. Well, so as a young conservation person, I used to talk about we a lot, but I got beat up regularly most places I went, particularly outside the United States, about who we, you know, and if you remember the old joke, it was who we white men, which is sort of exactly the point. So our panel is about who this we is and trying to really be sensitive about who we are talking about when we say this is our challenge. I was trained and practiced as a conservation professional, and over the last several years, on my own, have become very interested and committed to trying to bring together the communities of conservation and synthetic biology, which are two communities which heretofore really have spoken to each other almost hardly at all. And my community, as Alex referred to, is not only depressive, but tends to be technophobic. And it is important that we learn and educate ourselves about these technologies so that we in the conservation community can understand these larger issues. And as part of this effort, just because we're talking about federal practitioners, U.S. federal practitioners, Elaine Leslie is here from the National Park Service, and she has started an initiative with which I've become involved of trying to look at the role of invasive animals in U.S. National Park Service units. So many of these ideas here have a salience that should be immediately applicable there to that. So when you think about who the we is, when we think about who the partnerships are, I have three kinds of partners I want to talk about. The first is social scientists, and some reference is made to this, but most of the conversation has been about biological sciences in one way or another. Those guys, the social scientists, know stuff we really need to know. And some of it, for example, comes from, so some of you may have seen these studies on looking at women who have recently given birth and trying to make a decision about whether or not to vaccinate their babies. You know, very nice study, beautiful set of controls, and what if it turns out that 3/4 of those women, when given basic information about the positive advantages of vaccinating, increase their likelihood of vaccinating their baby. But you know what? 1/4 of those women decrease the chances of vaccinating when you present them with information. Well, I mean, I spent 30 years of my damned life convinced that if you gave better information to people, they made better decisions. Yeah. And I only hung around with 3/4 of people who said, oh my God, until I read your paper, I didn't realize that I was doing things wrong. Now I'm gonna change my life. Well, it turns out a lot of the people witnessed the last election do not particularly believe in this. So we have to change this notion that simply by publishing it in Science or giving the presentation that we are going to get them to change their minds. Now, so there's the second group, storytellers, Alex reference. 4 years, I've been talking to conservation people about synthetic biology. You know what? The two most common responses, how they're framed? They're framed, and reference was made to this earlier, they're framed around Jurassic Park and Frankenstein. Not a surprise to anybody in this room, but what does that tell you? That those both are works of fiction. So what you have is the future of our world being constrained by fiction that people have either watched in the theater or read. Probably they haven't read it, but because they don't realize that Frankenstein wasn't actually the monster, so is the doctor involved. There you go again. Do you think that that as a fact is going to change somebody's mind when I tell them to it? Actually, I've tried it and it really doesn't work. So storytelling, it's a fabulous book called Humans as Storytellers. And the author makes the case that if you say once upon a time, the audience is quiet. We are set to listen to stories. So I don't want to particularly write any more papers. I want to tell stories. And I think it's going to be an important part of our way of going forward. So the last group, I have heard hardly mention of the last group at all. And those are all the young people who aren't here because school's in session. So I don't know if everybody here knows about iGEM. I don't know you. I don't know what your background is. But it's a global competition that was established by Drew Endy and others, which brings together young people who invent new forms of life. And they have a jamboree, and they compare these novel life forms, and there are awards given. And this year, the competition was held in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and there were 43 high school teams. So we are raising a generation who will think of these technologies the way I think about, I don't know, computers. So much of this is going to be partnerships between our generation and younger generations. And to that point, some of you may have read, I love this story, it was in the BBC about 4 or 5 days ago. You may remember Martin, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce his name, Shkreli. He's the one who raised the price of Daraprim, this drug used for malaria and AIDS, from $13.50 a pill to $750 a pill. So a group of Australian high school students, whatever they call them in Australia, you can call them high school students. Mates, that's probably what they call them. They synthesized the major chemical component of Daraprim for $20. Who am I looking for partners? I'm going to look at high school students. I mean, there is an enormous power that we can't forget as we move this forward. So, and we also need to look at the human medicine and agriculture, because in case you haven't noticed it, all the money in this country is going towards the development of these new technologies in agriculture and human medicine. So, and I have talked to a few of these guys, and they say, geez, wow, you know, no, I could do that. Yeah, we know how to do that. I never thought of doing that. So partnerships with these other really richer sectors are going to be good ones for us. My favorite topic, if I were a venture capitalist, I'd put it into the genetic modification of microbiomes in invasive species. I haven't read anybody who talked about that. It may be that all this money directed to genomes of invasive species themselves is misspent, and we ought to be manipulating the microbiomes of these species. That's all I know about it, and I don't have any money, so I don't have to put my money behind it. So, perhaps unexpected partners, I bring you China. We don't know all of what's going on in synthetic biology in China, but you can be sure there's a lot. And so how interesting it would be to form a U.S. We can't do a Trans-Pacific partnership, but maybe we could do a China-U.S. partnership connected with invasive species management and genomic techniques. I have a book to recommend, so you have one on either end, and it's just been published. It's by a fabulous Brit development practitioner, and it's called How Change Happens, How Change Happens. And he's reviewed an enormous amount of the literature and practical experience about how change happens in the development community. And he's got some great ideas, including my favorite, which is called positive deviance, which is, instead of looking at norms in large tests, you actually look at the very small percentage of people who are succeeding at doing things well outside the second standard deviation and learn from them and bring that stuff back in. I think we could learn a lot from the development practitioners. And finally, I was reviewing some older papers in advance of this meeting and noticed that the invasive species used to be called alien species. And the last panel, God bless them, when they were asked a provocative question, they all became U.S. government employees, so I can say this and they can't. But maybe for the next administration, we should change the name from invasive species back to alien species and expect really high levels of funding for our work. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Kent. Some great ideas there. We obviously have some very good storytellers on our panel. Would any of our other storytellers like to contribute some additionals to either of those? Excellent. We'll open it up to questions then. Sarah and those with the mics, can we please pass around?
Hi. I'm contacted by small businesses every few months that have an application for aquatic invasive species. They are small for-profit companies, and so they have reached out to state agencies, they've reached out to federal agencies, and because their data and testing is done by their companies, the agencies are a little hesitant to even try and test it because they think that the data might be biased because they're for-profit companies. So what would you recommend, how would you recommend they navigate trying to break into the agency realm?
Joanna, I think that's yours.
So if I understood the question correctly, you're wondering about the case of small businesses that need their technology or solution tested, but there's sort of, it sounds like there's kind of a chicken and egg problem of we need this validated and no one's going to give them the time of the day until it's validated?
Correct.
Yep. So we see this all the time. It's a really big problem. And I don't think I have a silver bullet kind of solution, but I can tell you some of the things that we've tried and that I've seen and that we're thinking about. And that is, I guess, first of all, I think it is, this is my opinion, I think it is, you know, the proper role of government to overcome these kinds of chicken and egg problems or market failures, if you want to be fancy, that innovators do face. So I think there's a strong case to be made there, and a state agency, a government agency, I think is an appropriate place to do that. That is part of what we are trying to do with some of our programs right now. However, the dealing with the bureaucracy of doing that with a government partner can be challenging. We've looked at some other models, and something that can be really compelling is actually having another third party actually pay for this, so that there's no, so that there is no potential bias in the results. And in particular, you might want to look at a model that I used to be associated with at Fraunhofer. It's called TechBridge, where investors and large corporate partners, in this case, would actually pay an independent third-party lab to do testing of promising early-stage technologies, with the idea that they would then get a first look and be able to identify those technologies and solutions that were most likely to bear results. So that's one potential solution. It's still a tough model, and I think that the way that it can work best is, again, I'll probably repeat myself a few times, through public-private cooperation. Just to say that there does seem to be appetite among the investment community, and I can only speak for the energy community, but among the investment community and industry partners for whom finding disruptive new technologies and incorporating them into their business is going to be important. There does seem to be some appetite for those types of communities to actually fund that work, and then it would be on probably on the government side, maybe other nonprofit sector, other nonprofit organizations, to sort of set up the structure that enables that to happen, which is its own beast, right? It's dealing with contracting and IP and who has rights to the test results, and those can be a little bit thorny, but they're solvable. So I'd be happy to chat if that's of interest.
If I can just, I think that. There's an overall problem with data in general. And we tend to be, you know, in some ways there's too much of it, in other ways there's not enough of it. There's a need to vet it and a need to analyze it. And we're both overwhelmed, right? The amount of data in the world doubles every year. Like, we double the amount of data we've had compared to the rest of human history in a single year. And we have this challenge, right? We reject other forms of data. We reject CIS and science data, even though CIS and science data can be found highly reliable. And where we've seen changes are where we've been really bounded by constraints. So with open data and ways of using crowdsourcing to contribute data, this is actually how we figure out what's going on in Syria right now. And for the first time, the State Department has used open data to be able to look at this. So obviously, you know, we need to be thinking much more broadly about how do we use different types of data, how do we use different types of curations, how do we actually use the crowd to vet the crowd within what you're saying, and recognizing when data may help us with decision support, but not a clear answer where we need to do deeper investigations. One thing we did do at USAID just around technology, we are faced with thousands of new types of technology to address global development problems. Solar lamps are just a really simple problem. So we funded MIT, who then hired the head of Consumer Reports to actually start vetting entire classes of data on the same criteria based on the applications where we expected them to be used. And we're doing this for development data. We're using that same sort of Harvey Ball approach to actually say, you know, what is the best performing thing out there? It gives the others incentives to actually do better. We have this process with Underwriters Laboratory. We can create it within this situation.
With respect to that previous question about government being suspicious of data generated by the people who are trying to get their product approved. We don't have the EPA or FDA people on the panel anymore, but the EPA pesticides office approves pesticides based on the data generated by the manufacturer of the pesticide, and the FDA approves drugs tested by the pharmaceutical company, and they perhaps ought to be more suspicious. But, you know, the inconsistency here in terms of who is suspicious of data and who is not.
Would anyone from the audience who's with those entities like to comment on that, since I think it was directed away from this panel?
You know, it depends on whose data it is very often, because you build up an integrity of your lab or a, you know, whether it's a government lab or a private lab, that's a very important part of that process. If you just appear out of nowhere and you've got some data, then it's going to be viewed much more carefully.
So part of this panel is looking at how do we attract other innovators as well to this space. So if we can have any questions around that kind of area, since we're running another 5 minutes. Something provocative, Mike?
I can help you with that. So, Alex, you brought up prizes and challenges as a way, as a mechanism, a pull mechanism for driving people into the space, but it still doesn't account for how do you actually fund the prizes and challenges. The federal government is limited on what they can do because of the American Competes Reauthorization Act only limits it to American solvers, so to speak. So how do we actually work in that kind of system where the government's limited use of that tool may have a limited use of that particular tool? Because it is one of the most successful ones for driving people into the space.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and what I'll do is maybe just briefly reflect on my experience at USAID. Every prize and challenge we did in partnerships with other countries. So Saving Lives at Birth, which was the first grand challenge that Wendy Taylor talked about, was one where we put in $10 million, but were matched by $40 million by other governments, by other entities that could be able to address it. And what it allowed us to do was a couple of things. One is we could just greatly mitigate risk, right? So we could actually say we're distributing risk across the group. Different people have different risks with different solutions, but we can actually select and support a community of those types of solutions. I think the The second piece was that we then benefited from being able to actually leverage the ability to reach new solvers and new solutions across multiple countries, multiple sectors, multiple disciplines by being able to partner with others. We were able to just have much greater impact in terms of what we were doing. And then that was really important because then we could scale up through many different countries, many different partners around that approach. So for us, I think that was everything I did in the Office of Science and Technology. Everything we did with the Grand Challenges was done in partnership. And I think recognizing that there are opportunities for partnership with the private sector, there are opportunities with partnership with philanthropy, recognizing that there are partnerships for opportunities with other countries who have different levels of risk and who allow you to actually speak about great things like leverage and the leverage that we bring. I think the other thing is just we undervalue prizes and challenges and pay for performance mechanisms, right? We tend to believe that these ideas of grants where we pray and we hope that people will actually deliver on a particular solution is the thing. Even contracts are set up where most of the contract is funded before we know that they're gonna be successful. Most of the monitoring and evaluation is done past the point. Prizes and challenges actually pay for success. And for us, being able to say you don't get paid until you actually deliver it, it doesn't work for everyone, but it's an amazing, effective tool that we can actually create entire new communities, entire new markets for what we're trying to do. So that is one that I value deeply.
I would just add, you're right that the federal government is somewhat limited in terms of the prize authority. There are limits to what the government can do through the prize authority. But there are other opportunities, and so some of the open innovation platforms that are out there, like Innocentive and Nine Sigma, they require sponsors right at the outset. So that might be challenging if you don't see a concrete private sector pull right off the bat. But other entities, XPRIZE being the most famous but not the only, actually take a more of a collaborative approach to identifying is this a topic that would be appropriate for a grand scale challenge, prize challenge, and if so, we'll actually work to identify private sector funds very often from philanthropic donors. So those types of options, I would caution against making an assumption about what step has to come first. Sometimes it's the problem and the partners, and then there are ways to get at the funding, and that has been successful in some surprising cases in the past.
And I want to jump in on this. It is really important how you frame this. Mm-hmm. And how you frame the questions and the challenges and even the statements. If you're looking to get the same old, then frame with the same old language. If you're actually looking to get other people, then that language is incredibly important, I think, to what you're trying to get. And it matters. It matters to the very people you're trying to attract. I remember my first trip out, I was appointed chief scientist at AIDE. I went out to Silicon Valley and I met all these people who could not care that I existed. And who could not care that the world's biggest bilateral development agency, we didn't matter to them. And we actually had to make that case. We had to change the very way that we approached the problem and how we got those people to participate to actually then matter.
Yes, I think we're hearing here a suite of mechanisms that are really aimed to be catalytic, that are aimed to look for engagement outside of the spheres and networks and that we currently have. Yeah, and I think this is, there's some really powerful tools here. And the other one, and storytelling, as Kent alluded to, is really powerful. The partners that are currently with the genetic biocontrol invasive rodents program that I presented earlier, they actually came to us while we're doing a horizon scanning exercise, and actually it came out that we had geneticists that were working on mice doing cancer models and other things, thinking, wow, you guys are really not doing these other projects that great because of some press stuff that got out. And they actually said, well, hey, we think we could do this and we could harness these technologies that we're working with on day-to-day. We never would have found them otherwise if they hadn't kind of, but then also taking the time to listen to something that sounded pretty crazy at the time, to be honest, and actually listen it through and actually take the time to understand it as to, what it is and where it's coming from. Most of the craziest ideas in that you hear first off, may end up being some of the best. So on that, I'd like to close up and end by saying that, you know, there's a heap of different ways that we can do this, and we definitely can do this. So go out there, everyone, and get them.